So let me introduce the panel very, very briefly in the order in which you see them here. Jedediah Purdy is the Everett Professor of Law at Duke, where he teaches environmental and constitutional law, legal theory, and political thought. He teaches wide-ranging courses on the meaning of things, including things like the past and future of capitalist democracy. He's been a visiting faculty member at Yale and Harvard and Georgetown. He's a well-known public writer as well as an academic writer. Four previous books, For Common Things, Being America, A Tolerable Anarchy, and The Meaning of Property. We are here to hear about and discuss his recent book, After Nature. John Cannon, to Mr. Purdy's left, is the Blaine T. Phillips Distinguished Professor of Environmental Law at the University of Virginia Law School, where he is also the Director of the Environmental and Land Use Law Program. He joined the law school faculty in 1998 from the Environmental Protection Agency, where he served as general counsel. He's written on institutional design for a number of different kinds of programs, and his recent book, which we're here to discuss, is Environment in the Balance, the Green Movement, and the Supreme Court. And then finally, to the left of Mr. Cannon is Ronald Bailey, who is an award-winning science correspondent for Reason Magazine and Reason.com, where he writes a weekly column. He is the author previously of Liberation Biology, The Moral and Scientific Case for the Biotech Revolution. He's had his work published in The Best American Science and Nature Writing. And he's written, he's also a widely published public writer with articles, reviews, and columns in places like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and other such. And he is a resident of Charlottesville, I should say. And the book that we are here to hear about and to discuss is The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. So I'm going to invite each author to say something about their books, but because they are such big picture depictions of an intellectual landscape, I wanted to ask you to first say something about that big picture that you're bringing into view. So if you haven't seen them already, each of these three books offers a political history of American ideas of nature or of the environment. And so I'd like to ask, if you would, each panelist, to sort of give us a five-minute history, your five-minute political history of the American idea of nature. And if you don't mind, for reasons of my own intuition, I wanted to begin with Mr. Cannon and then go to Mr. Bailey and end with Mr. Purdy, if that's okay with you.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Willis. So I'm going to give a short history. My history begins in 1970 or thereabouts with the first Earth Day and what is commonly understood to be the birth of the modern environmental movement. Jed will provide a much deeper, richer, and more thoroughgoing cultural context that goes back to the origins of the Republic and before. So when Jed talks, you can put my piece sort of in that broader context because that's really where it belongs. But the environmental movement that began in the 1970s, some of you, I was alive when that happened. Some of the rest of you were. So you understand what that moment was about. And in my view, at least, it was a moment when a lot of people who harbored what they considered to be private grievances about the way land was being developed, the way factories were being operated, the way industrial-scale activities were taking place across landscapes, people having those private grievances, and there were many, came together and realized that those private grievances were really common concerns. And that recognition read a movement which turned out to have some considerable political force and produced a number of major laws. I'm a lawyer. I'm very interested in the laws, and I've spent a long time working with and studying these laws, laws like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and I could go on. A major legal revolution that was born in some significant sense from this social, or as I will argue, cultural movement. Those laws in turn generated a bunch of Supreme Court decisions interpreting those laws against a background of constitutional principles and against a background of interpretational approaches to figuring out what the laws actually meant and how they should be implemented. And I make a living reading those cases and trying to understand what they mean as a matter of legal doctrine and precedent. But what occurred to me after years of reading these cases and teaching these cases in the classroom was that there was something more going on underneath them, underneath the surface, I will say, than just straightforward legal interpretation. That is, the justices' orientation toward these cases had something to do with beliefs and values that shaped their approach to the case. And because there are diverse results in these cases with justices lining up in different positions, it is clear that these beliefs and values aren't uniform among members of the court. That is, the court has, or members of the court have competing beliefs and values that orient them in these cases. And my focus here was on environmental cases. And I went back and tried through researching social psychology and the environmental literature to piece together the different worldviews that might be operating among the justices in these cases to explain these different results and these different articulations which I was seeing in these cases. And I posited two worldviews, basically, as operative in this setting, which are worldviews that are generally discussed in talking about the environmental movement. One is the dominant social paradigm, which focuses on free economic activity, economic growth, material abundance, individualism, as part of a set of basic American values. And then on the other side, the new environmental paradigm, which focuses on concerns about scarcity, concerns about the fragility of the natural environment, concerns about the interconnectedness of environmental systems and their vulnerability to human interference, and also emphasizes collective action as a way of dealing with those concerns. And in my reading of the cases, I discern cues, expressive hints, if you will, of the presence of these competing value sets operating under the legal language of the opinions. I mean, justices don't typically say, in fact, they almost never say, I'm deciding this case because my worldview is such and such. They say, I'm deciding this case because the legal doctrine compels it, or precedent compels it, or the interpretational principles applicable compel it. But in high-profile cases where the law is unsettled and where there are politically or culturally salient issues, one imagines that there is something else at work. Justices, after all, are human. And the fact that justices, who are all intelligent, well-trained, come out on different sides of these issues consistently suggests that there's something else operating than just a set of neutral principles. So that's the project of my book, is to discern, is to sort of interpret these opinions and to try to identify the work that these competing paradigms may be doing under the surface to orient the justices to different outcomes. And then at the end of the book, kind of turn the lens around and take what I've learned from that analysis and try to apply it in assessing the current state of the environmental movement and some suggested moves that environmentalists might consider to expand, broaden, and make more effective their appeals to the broader public to deal with current problems.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Mr. Bailey.
I'm not a scholar, I'm not a scientist, but I'm a journalist, and I've been a science journalist for quite some time and working in various media. And what I want to do is explain how I came to this particular topic, if I may. Back in the Middle Ages in 1970s, here at UVA, I was a student here at UVA, and I was being taught by my professors what were then the dominant, what became, if you will, the canonical texts of modern environmentalism, the sort of modern environmentalism we just mentioned earlier. And, for example, The Limits to Growth came out the year I entered the University of Virginia, and that, of course, made a huge effect at that time. Basically, it was, if you go into the middle of The Limits to Growth, there's a little chart there which lists all of the critical minerals resources of the time, and it basically says we're going to run out of things like tin, zinc, molybdenum, whatever you want, before 2000. But even if you assumed five times more, we would be run out by now of all these things. The world was running into a world of scarcity, and it was going to be terrible. Prior to that, of course, was The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. And his basic statement was, in that book, and you should always read the 1968 version because he changed it later, but in the 68 version he said, hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death in the 1970s in spite of any crash programs that might be embarked upon now. Hundreds of millions were going to starve to death. Prior to that, of course, and the person who I think really gets most of the credit for starting and sparking what became the environmental movement was Rachel Carson, of course, in Silent Spring. And in Silent Spring, among many other things that she argued was that because of our exposures to synthetic chemicals, pesticides particularly worried her, we were going to have massive cancer epidemics and that people were going to die of cancer epidemics because of these exposures. Of course, she had other things to say, which she was correct about, as it turned out, with regard to how this was affecting bird populations and so forth. In any case, so here I am a student. I'm 18, 20 years old, and my very smart professors are telling me basically that I'm going to be dead in another 10 years or so. And so in the fullness of time, I became a staff writer at Forbes magazine in New York, and I looked up one day and I noticed that we were still here. And this puzzled me, and I went to my brilliant editor, Jim Michaels, and I said, what I'd like to do is go back and reread these classics and other works and do a series of articles based on what, and go to the people who wrote them if they were still alive, and go to the people and ask them, well, what happened? Well, in my naivete at the time, I thought, well, what was going to happen is that I would call up Paul Ehrlich, which I did do, and we had a nice long chat, and I was quoting him from his book, and he basically said, no, Ron, the famines are still coming. And this is true. He told me this in 1991. The famines are still coming. And I said, what? I said, well, I got my timing wrong. It's going to happen between 2000 and 2010. Okay. I went up to MIT and talked to the people who had done the modeling for The Limits to Growth and spent all day with them, again, my dog-eared, marked-up copy of The Limits to Growth. And they were very nice, and we had a very nice discussion about their projections at the time. And finally, one of them turned to me at the end of our day and said, well, all right, we perhaps overemphasized the material resources side too much. And I said, okay, interesting. I couldn't talk to Rachel Carson because she had unfortunately died of cancer in the early 1960s, but I did talk to folks who were very concerned about exposures to synthetic pesticides and so forth, and I talked to a lot of cancer epidemiologists, and they basically said this was not true. So what slowly but surely was dawning on me is, at the time, was that to a certain extent, a lot of these problems were used as ways of advancing an agenda for a different kind of world, a different vision of the way that people thought the world should be organized. And that environmentalism, as opposed to ecological science, was in fact a political doctrine and not a scientific medium. So I put all these things together. By the way, I also read about global warming at the time, and the ozone hole was a big problem at the time. And on those, for example, the ozone hole, I concluded that we needed an international treaty to handle that problem, and so wrote it. In any case, I figured eventually I had enough material for a book, so I managed to get a publisher, St. Martin's Press, in 1992. And the guy who was my editor turned to me and said, because the book came out more or less, that the trends, you know, there are environmental problems, but the trends are not desperate. We're not all going to die in another generation or so. And he, after we signed the contract, and I'm quoting here, he turned to me and said, you know, Ron, if you'd come to me with a book saying the world was coming to an end, I could have made you a rich man. And he also told me we were going to make some money off of it and that kind of thing, and we did, and it was fine. And so 20 years later, I decided to look at the trends again, and this is the book. I wanted to know, well, what did I get right, what did I get wrong, and where are we going now? And there were some trends that I hadn't looked at. In the first book, I was somewhat skeptical of global climate change. In this one, I basically say, well, I was wrong. On the other hand, when I wrote the first book, the National Academy of Sciences had a major study, 900-page study out, saying that basically we don't know if the warming that has occurred is natural or not at this point. So I was in good company to be somewhat skeptical in those days. But 10 years ago, I basically said the balance of the evidence is that man is causing global warming, and it's a problem. We need to handle it. But so I again go through a lot of the population stuff, and I have lots of good news with regard to that. World population is likely to top out at around 8 to 9 billion in the middle of the century and start declining. And this is good because it means it's essentially women are liberated and will be having choices about their reproduction planet-wide. The amount of farmland that is likely to be used to produce the food for the 9 billion people in the middle of the century will be something like 10% less than we're currently using. And if we would get rid of the idiotic ethanol subsidies, even more land would revert to nature. I also talk about the extinction crisis and why I think that there are ways that there are hopeful signs in that regard as well. In any case, again, I have, as far as I can tell, as objectively as I think I can, looked at the data. And if I may, I'd like to read you my conclusion. It's a paragraph. New technologies and wealth produced by human creativity will spark a vast environmental renewal in this century. Most global trends suggest that by the end of the century, the world will be populated with fewer and much wealthier people living mostly in cities fueled by cheap, no-carbon energy sources. As the amount of land and sea needed to supply human needs decreases, both cities and wild nature will expand, with nature occupying or reoccupying the bulk of the land and the sea freed up by human ingenuity. Nature will become chiefly an arena for human pleasure and instruction, not a source of raw materials. I don't fear for future generations. Instead, I rejoice for them. In any case, I hope that I'll be able to persuade you of some of that this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for being here, to the festival's organizers and to Willis Jenkins for very generously agreeing to curate this panel. So the history that I'll give is a kind of prehistory to both John Cannon's and Ron Bailey's. And it does intersect in at least one very important thematic way with something that Ron said, which is that environmentalism after the 70s was at least in part an agenda for a different kind of world, which I think is true, maybe more than one agenda for more than one different kind of world. So, pardon me. So it's actually been true as long as there has been an American relation to the natural world, all the way back in the history of European settlement in North America. Questions about how to shape, relate to the larger world that we're set in have been, at the same time, questions about nature and questions about people. They have always been, in a sense, questions about what kind of world people want to live in. And in that way, they've been precursors to a question that, I think circumstances now force upon us, because we now find ourselves in an era that more and more earth scientists and others tell us we would do well to rename in geological terms the Anthropocene or New Age of Humanity, indicating the fact that people have become a geological force, maybe the defining geological force in the development of the planet as a whole system. And so going forward, the world that we get to live in will be and can only be in good part the world that we have shaped by the collective implicit landscape architecture of our economic activity and by the collective political choices that we make to give that economic activity the shape that will in turn give the next ecology a shape. None of this is necessarily pessimistic, I think, on the contrary. But it is about the kind of world that we'll move forward into. So we all have that in common, I think, in the questions we're posing. So here, in short, is the history. I'll sketch it for you, and then I'll give a recent example of how it continues to play out in the very concrete headlines, not the presidential campaign. So there have been three ways of... There were, before the 1970s, three ways of thinking about the human place in the natural world, what it was about nature that mattered, how people fit within it, and how they ought to conduct themselves to get right in relation to it, that were key not just as a matter of cultural or literary history, but key actually in contributing to eras of politics and of lawmaking in the United States that in turn shaped and continue to shape the material landscape that we actually live upon. And so give us some sense of precedence when we think of how to look forward, asking what sort of world we're going to live in, and also do the kind of essential historian's work of helping us to see how it is that we got to where we are. So the first of these I'm going to call the frontier view of nature. This is an idea that is really predominant in politics, public law, even theology, for at least the first 100 years of American independence and also for the Anglo-colonial period preceding it. It's based on a view of nature, which is that nature has a plan, and that plan is to get developed, to get developed by us, by our settling in it, clearing it, planting it. An enormous amount of the first 100 years of public law in the United States is basically a series of offers to Americans to go to the frontier and conduct what those of you who read political philosophy in the past will recognize as a John Locke-style transaction with nature, where you mix your labor with a portion of it and turn it into private property, which the government will recognize by planting, by clearing, by irrigating, by draining, by mining, by building, whatever it is that brings it into the logic of development and economic productivity. This was an idea about what nature was for that worked in part to justify the expropriation of Native American land claims and their replacement by an Anglo-American style of ownership. It also had, from our point of view, a more attractive or affirmative view, which was connected with the rise of democracy as a political culture in the 19th century, a political culture premised on the dignity of every man, or at least of every property-holding or potentially property-holding white man, which rested on the idea of the dignity of labor, that when you went out and worked with your hands, you weren't doing degraded work. You were participating in making the world bloom the way it was supposed to be. You were part of a national and human mission. So much of the private property across the continent is still the product, literally the product, of a legal scheme intended to put this view of nature into practice, which succeeded enormously, especially in the eastern portion of the country where agriculture can be supported without irrigation, and therefore the small-scale farm model of development was especially successful. second kind of view of nature is one that came into prominence in the late 19th, early 20th century, and was closely associated with Teddy Roosevelt's program of conservation, with the creation of the national forests and other public lands that are put to economic use as well as recreational use, associated also with the development of the massive irrigation systems across the West. And this was a view that nature is intended to benefit people, yes, but that its systems work on scales that are too vast in space and time and too intense in their complexity to be managed by the kinds of decentralized individual decisions that were the core of the developmental agenda of the frontier vision. Instead, this argument went, natural systems needed to be managed on the scale of the system, and they needed to be managed by experts in those systems. The idea that this was what nature required was a powerful part of the rationale for the development of the modern national state in the early 20th century. The federal government needed agencies and experts that could make nature productive. And this was very closely related also to a new view of the state's responsibility with respect to the social world and the economic world. Roosevelt once said that his whole domestic project of reform, which included labor law, antitrust law, public health law, these were all examples of the principle of conservation applied generally, of managing complex systems for public benefit at the scale of the systems and under the guidance of expertise. The third pre-1970 view is the view of nature as inspiration. It's the romantic view that says the key human relationship to nature is when you go out into some spectacular place, some lonesome, dramatic place, and some people would say you see God there. Some people would say you get clearer about who you are and what's important to you. You get renewed in some way. These are ways of talking that are intuitive to us. They were novel when they became the basis of a social movement in the late 19th century, a romantic social movement aimed at preserving public lands like Yosemite Valley, like Yellowstone National Park, these dramatic settings where the thought was you could experience a kind of spiritual inspiration and elevation. And they're familiar to us in part because the landscapes where that kind of encounter is the paradigm have been preserved by acts of public law from 1872 when Yellowstone was preserved forward. So that idea about what happens when a person encounters a wild place is actually available to us day to day in our lived lives. So these are all examples of ways that law and legal institutions and politics have both been shaped by ideas about the natural world and in turn have shaped the physical landscape that we live on by regulating it in response to these visions about how nature matters and how we should live with respect to it. So in that sense, it's always been about what kind of world we're going to be in, and it continues to be. So I promised that I would give a very brief example of how this plays out today. Think about something many of you will have noticed in the news. The occupation of a national wildlife refuge in southeastern Oregon in January by a group of right-wing activists, some of them associated or allegedly associated with the militia movement in the region. Their claim was, this land is really ours. It really belongs to local governments, constitutionally speaking. They have an interesting constitutional argument to that effect. And it fundamentally, morally, belongs to people who use it productively. It belongs to the miners and the ranchers and the loggers, and not to the bird watchers and not to the bureaucrats. So this is the 21st century expression of the frontier view of what nature needs and what the most valuable human relation is to it and which human attitudes toward it have authority, coming smack up against the managerial bureaucratic landscape scale expert management that the National Wildlife Refuges as a legal structure embody and their managers embody, and against a certain version of the kind of romantic recreational encounter with nature that, for example, the bird watchers that at least some of my liberal internet hoped would somehow liberate the wildlife refuge from the occupiers represent. We don't have time to go through a story of how each of these views has persisted in certain constituencies and certain legal regimes and certain landscapes so that they can come into conflict in these ways today. But it's an example of how it continues to happen.
Thank you very much. John, you were very economical in offering an account of the story you're telling, and I just wanted could I get you to say another word about what you see as the fate of environmentalism or the environmental idea as you read it through the Supreme Court decisions of the past few decades? Because your book is offering a narrative, and I'd just love to have you say something about that.
All right, that's thank you. Thank you for a second shot. So my book looks at Supreme Court opinions across 45 years plus, from 1970 to the present day, and tries to get a sense of not only legally but culturally what's going on in those opinions. And I use that examination then to step back and say, well, what do these cases say, if anything, about the progress of the environmental movement? And if they do say anything, what does it mean for the future of environmentalism? I think it's fair to say that at the beginning of the environmental movement in the early 1970s, you found the court quite receptive to the basic mood of the times, the strong apparent consensus behind environmentalism. And I agree, Ron, environmentalism is not just a scientific enterprise. It's a cultural and political orientation. I would say cultural, but you could describe it as political as well. It has certain beliefs and values that are a part of it. And the court seemed receptive to that in the early days. There's a case called Overton Park in which the court made clear under a statute provided by Congress that was not entirely clear itself that public parks were not to be sacrificed to the construction of the interstate highway system. So a park in Memphis was ultimately saved from being bisected through a portion of old growth forest in that park by an interstate highway development. These and other cases indicated, and you can look at the language and see that the court is not only giving the environmentalists a holding that's beneficial, but the language of the court suggests sympathy with the basic narratives that the environmentalists are offering, that the environment is under threat, that unless we check ourselves, we're going to have a ruined or a less desirable world, and that ruination is proceeding at a faster and faster pace, which creates urgency on the part of the court and other authorities to step in and control the damage. But as time goes on, the court registers less and less sympathy, I would say, becomes more neutral in its stance in these environmental cases, and sometimes quite skeptical. And more and more evidences a real division among members of the court about what the proper orientation or response to these cases might be. So you get a body of justices, typically described as conservative justices, who show quite little sympathy in environmental cases often, who are resistant to government efforts to expand regulation, who are concerned about infringement on private property rights, who are concerned about the expansion of federal power, all elements of what I've described as the dominant social paradigm. And on the other side, you have justices who are more sympathetic to the environmental view in these cases, that show greater comfort with collective action, with regulation, with government intervention, that show greater concern about the impact of human activity on natural resources, and that are concerned about the unequal distributional effects of environmental harms in environmental cases. So from that, I deduce that what looked like at the beginning of the environmental movement, a transformation of our culture. Everybody in the 1970s professed to be an environmentalist. Ronald Reagan said he was an environmentalist. That was the theme of the time. These statutes that I'm talking about, these federal environmental statutes, were passed by very large majorities, very little opposition in Congress, large majorities in both parties. So it looked as if these environmental values, which we now know from Jed's narrative, aren't new, but are an extension and expansion and transformation of values that have been in the culture for some time. It looked like these values were transforming, becoming dominant and pervasive. But what I see in the court opinions is that, at least on the court, that isn't the case. And in fact, there is a very strong and continuing cultural opposition along the fault lines of the environmental movement. And in the last chapter of the book, I say, well, is that just the court, or is that representative more broadly in society? And I look at a number of studies, look at a number of polls, and conclude that, in fact, the environmental movement has not been, although it's had many successes, it has not been successful in its basic transformational effort. That is, the dominant social paradigm is still very strong, still very influential. And even though a majority of people claim to be sympathetic to environmentalism, there's a lot of evidence that that sympathy is not very deep or not very strong and tends to back away when issues like economic progress and growth and so forth are posed against it. So the question then at the end of the book is, well, what does that mean for the environmental movement of the future? Should the environmental movement keep doing what it's doing? Should it still embrace the same beliefs and values and forge ahead? It's had successes in the past, and that would be one option. What I see, however, within the movement is a lot of questioning, self-criticism, and initiatives to try to push the movement into a broader social stance so that it becomes appealing in ways that it has not been in the past to groups of people that it has not been in the past. So greater effort to engage private property owners, greater effort to engage private capital, greater effort to work, and the Environmental Defense Fund and other environmental groups are already doing this, to work with corporations in a real way, not just a greenwash way, but a real way to produce environmental benefits, a way to engage people who are individualists, who would otherwise not be attracted to the communalism that some people identify with environmentalism. I talk about a bee farmer at Wolf Creek Farm in Virginia, who's a staunch libertarian, but who is also a very strong environmentalist, who raises beef that would qualify as, you know, blue ribbon on any environmental index that you might suggest. I mean, he does raise beef. Some people object to that. But if you grant that beef raising is okay, he does it in an environmentally impeccable way. And his view is, I do that because that expresses my own value set, my own preferences. I do it without government subsidies. I do it without government interference. I do it in private contract with others who want to buy the beef because what I produce is what they want to buy. And if the government interferes, I will be disabled from pursuing this environmental project that I have. Well, that's very interesting to me. I don't think you could generalize that into a into a new pattern of environmentalism, as some would suggest, but I think it's an important addition to the cultural set that can be associated with environmentalism and developed in the new agriculture, which is one of the new branches of the environmental movement that I think is very, very important. So my conclusions are very tentative. I don't have a broad silver bullet to offer the environmental community, but I do encourage this kind of exploration, particularly in a time of self-questioning within the movement and in a time of immense challenges that the movement is facing that require some additional power, cultural, political power, to address, like climate change and other major global issues.
Thank you very much. I want to draw each of you out on what you make of cultural contests over environmental issues in an apparently polarized time, and then after that, hear what questions you all may have. And I want to start with you, Ron. It's interesting to me that both John Cannon and Ron Bailey are impressed by some of the same research on cultural cognition. So you both cite Dan Kahan, who's working from through mediaries, the anthropologist Mary Douglas, about how people interpret scientific information, often to confirm some background worldview or paradigm of organizing risk and self and society. And so I'd like to hear from you first, Ron, what you make of that research for what it means for a time of cultural conflict. I mean, should we feel pessimist or optimist about the high role that culture appears to play in your argument?
I think I should briefly describe what Cannon's up to.
Please, yes.
All right, so what Dan Cannon is doing is the head of something called the Yale Cultural Cognition Project, and I'm really impressed with the kind of work he's doing. He's basically building off of work by a brilliant political scientist from Berkeley named Aaron Waldofsky, and who came up with a schema for American politics, which he could divide Americans into four groups: communalists, who think everybody should take care of everybody else; egalitarians, who want everybody to share equally; individualists, who want basically to take advantage of the system for the benefit of themselves and their families and so forth; and hierarchists, who are more or less the sort of people who want order and stability in their society. And so one of the more brilliant studies that he did very early on was over nanotechnology. Now, I don't know if anyone knows what nanotechnology is, but when he did the study, nobody knew what nanotechnology was. And so what he did was he called up 1,600 Americans, put them into the system, and then asked them to figure out which way they were and where they fit in their hierarchies and which group they fit into. And then they asked the following question: what do you think about nanotechnology? And most of the people go, what? And so then he says, here, we're going to read you a one-sentence description of some of the benefits and costs of nanotechnology. And what they discovered is the egalitarians, communitarians were going, oh, sounds a little risky, got to be careful about this stuff, go a little slow maybe. And then the hierarchists and the individuals were going, really sounds interesting, maybe we should invest a little bit more in this and look at the research, it looks good. But their hope was that they got a subset of these people, and they said, all right, our hypothesis is, if we now tell everybody more information about a scientific or technological issue, with more information, they will come together. That was their hypothesis. So they read a much longer description of nanotechnology to this subset of people, and it turned out that the communalists and egalitarians said, we must ban this stuff now. This is terrible. And the hierarchists and individuals go, where do I invest? So he has now generalized this. Their hope had been that what we could do is we could all talk together and come up together and come up with a particular democratic solution to various problems that are entailed by science or technology. And what he's discovered is that when a scientific issue becomes politicized, And trust me, there's nothing that's not anymore. People start signaling to each other what tribe they're a member of. And what they do is they look to the people that they think are like them, who believe like them. And so what you end up with is, and they did a wonderful analysis of this, is most scientists think that nuclear power is pretty safe. Most egalitarians and most egalitarians and communalists go, no, we gotta ban it. And most hierarchists agree with the scientists, the scientific consensus. My favorite one of this is that most scientists think genetically modified crops are perfectly safe to eat and safe for the environment. I mean, this is as strong a consensus among the scientists as you can find, stronger even than the climate change consensus. And most egalitarians and communitarians go, absolutely not. I want this stuff labeled. I don't want anything to do with it. They ignore the science because they're signaling to each other a certain thing, a certain way that they believe about the world. On the other hand, I find it then amusing when the same egalitarians and communitarians go, consensus on climate change, we've got to go with the consensus. So you pick your consensus based on who you are politically, and it's really hard to figure out how to get people to talk. And I just did last week I did a column which got me in a lot of trouble with some researchers, but anyway, where the most disheartening thing is with regard to climate change consensus, which by the way I accept, is that if you look at conservatives, the more scientifically literate conservatives are, this is Dan Kahan's research, the more scientifically literate they are, they go, yes, we absolutely know that there is a scientific consensus. We just don't believe it. And so when you get into a politicized situation like this, it's really hard to make those discussions, which is why plugging my book makes a wonderful bar mitzvah, wedding, holiday, Easter's coming up. What is that I try not to talk about the motives of the researchers I'm talking about in here for the most part. There's one person whose motives I do talk about, but you'll have to read the book who that, find out who that person is. But I hope that was at least an adequate introduction to what Dan Kahan's work is doing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Do you want to say a word, and then I'll ask Jed what he thinks about cultural
conflict. Okay, yeah. These are reductionistic studies. They're very helpful, but they're reductionistic. They sort of fit people into, you know, individualism.
Isn't science reductionist? Isn't science reductionism?
Oh, yeah, well, that's fine. But I mean, there are categories that not everyone here probably would recognize themselves as fitting in perfectly. And that's not really the point. That there are different emphases within these categories, and people are more or less one kind or the other. And we all probably share some, you know, portion of all of these values. Ron's point is, I think, worth emphasizing. The studies on climate change that Kahan did showed that the individualist hierarchs tend to be more skeptical of the science, the climate change science. Why? Because they see big government behind the climate science coming to regulate their business, their property, whatever. And the communalists, the egalitarians are much more comfortable with that and don't, and say, yes, we're screwing up the environment. We always knew we were screwing up the environment. So, you know, we got to recognize that and do better. And as Ron said, the further difficulty is that the more scientifically literate the people are who are included in these surveys, the more opposed they become along cultural lines. That is, the fact that you could understand the science if you spent the time, that you have the capacity, that you have the computational skills to actually come to terms with the science, means that you are more confident in the culturally induced view that you tend to adopt, which is sort of dispiriting, right? I mean, the notion that we just can't get out of this by being smarter is pretty discouraging. But there are, I think there is hope behind these studies, and Dan Kahan would say this, that there are environments where you can diffuse the cultural valence of these issues. Maybe that's what Ron's trying to do in his book, but people are trying to do it in different settings and get people to come perhaps slowly and step by step to a sense of common interest in finding out what is actually going on. And that's, he's done some studies in South Florida where the sea is rising and floods are occurring and basements are underwater that show that conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, when they're faced with a common problem, can actually sit down together and get beyond this we-them kind of confrontation and get to some real solutions that are common. And I think that is hopeful.
Good. I'm beginning to feel a little more hopeful. Thank you. But Jed, I would like to hear your take on this, because you've given us reasons to see something like the Malheur as a site of contest between different background narratives and imaginations. Is that reason for pessimism or optimism, or how should we interpret that?
Well, probably not as simple as one or the other exactly. I think of the very interesting work of Dan Kahan's that Ron has been describing, his work that I've been interested in for a long time, as I know John Cannon also has, as in certain ways, and I speak as an admirer of the work, in certain ways symptomatic of something about our cultural moment. I think of your previously local social psychologist, Jonathan Haidt, similarly. We are fascinated by systematic, schematic descriptions of our own dysfunction and incapacity to get our act together collectively. And we seem to take a certain satisfaction in these demonstrations that if you just see where you are on the grid, then you'll see why you and your neighbors aren't going to do a damned thing about this problem, even though you know you ought to. So I wonder why that is. I suspect a part of it is that the polarization of our politics has not been polarization simpliciter. It's been polarization in the context of a very substantial failure of the national government to get, and most state governments, to get much of anything done other than launch counterproductive wars for several decades. So in a certain sense, politics gets to be a festival of warring resentments and warring fantasies and competing signals about your identity, almost recreationally, because its stakes and consequences don't get played out by anything actually following as a result. So a lot of the particular ways that we are tribally divided right now, I think, may be symptomatic of that particular moment that we find ourselves in. I find a couple of benefits of drawing back and taking a somewhat longer view of these themes. One is that it's, again, as I was saying before, it's always been true that when people argue over what ought to be done with respect to the natural world, that ideas about what kind of social world is best and why, and what kinds of individual dispositions and practices are really valuable to cultivate and why, have just been part and parcel of that all along. So in this way, the Kahan research that Ron is talking about does, I think, tap into some very deep human patterns that we've never really thought of ourselves in the larger world that we're part of as independent questions or value-free technical questions. And actually, whenever we've managed to get any traction for the idea of thinking of the management of nature as a value-free technical question, there have actually been very intense moral and political ideas behind achieving that kind of rationality. Ideas about what it's legitimate for the state to do, that is, serve the general and objective interest of the public. Ideas about how you show respect for your fellow citizens, which is by making appeals to their concrete material shared interests rather than their kind of idiosyncratic aesthetic or moral views, and so on. The title of Ron's publication, Reason, it crystallizes a whole idea about the sort of dignified and mature human view and the kind of relation to nature and state that we can have, and a very significant one at that. I also think the longer view helps us to see that in some ways, maybe what is less interesting, ultimately, let me start that sentence elsewhere. What is more interesting than to organize our present divisions along, say, communitarian and individualist, egalitarian and hierarchical lines, is to ask how the range of possible values, values and worldviews that people can inhabit across a whole society moves across time. So let's say there have always been hierarchists, communitarians, individualists, but the range of options on the table for how we ought to live together, what that means for relations among people in different economic classes, relations between men and women, questions of gender diversity, relations of race, have changed enormously. A hierarchical individualist in Charlottesville in 1830 would have had a very different view of all of these questions from a hierarchical individualist in 2016, and conversely for all the other views. So I think that unless we're completely satisfied that we have in front of us all the resources to grapple satisfactorily with the challenges of global environmental problems, we ought to be interested in the fact that we're a species whose nature seems to be that we change our own nature across time by argument, by mobilization, by insight, by learning, and change, the whole landscape of political options and identities that these schematics travel across. And I think that grappling with the Anthropocene situation may induce that kind of reflection and that kind of change again.
Excellent. Thank you. At this point, we have 13 minutes for your questions. What I'd like to invite you to do is please be concise, and if you would like to address your question to a particular panelist, please do so. What I would propose to do is to take initially three questions at once, so we can have them all on the table. So panelists, you have to pay attention.
All right.
So we'll have here. And then here. I think you were the third.
And if the questioners could give us their first names, we can keep track of those.
My name is Frank. Ron, in view of your optimistic view...
Realistic.
If you were asked, should there be any particular government policies and regulations adopted now, what would you recommend?
Excellent.
The recent book by the Pulitzer Prize winner Jane Mayer called Dark Money. It talks about the role of large amounts of private capital in shaping the economic and political response of our country to many issues, including environmental issues. And I wonder if you could comment on what you think the positive or negative role of big money is now on environmental life in this country.
And is that for the panel generally? Or for someone in specific?
It could be anybody.
Okay, excellent. And then...
could be for anybody generally.
Excellent.
I'm Dave from the Eastern Shore. The Chesapeake Bay is very important to us. What kinds of positive suggestions could you make for... You talk about the two paradigms very broadly. I've always sort of thought about it, well... we've got jobs, people, we've got bird people. We've got to work together. What kind of positive suggestions could you make for whichever side we tend to be on that we could be conciliatory in our small grassroots organizations and communities?
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Ron, the first question was addressed to you.
I want to start with two principles first, and then I'll get to a specific thing. And this first one, if you take nothing away from what I say today, remember this and just think it over in the dark of the night. Everything you think is an environmental problem, whatever it is you personally think is an environmental problem out there, that problem is occurring in an open access commons. It is occurring in a river, a lake, an atmosphere, a forest, a fisheries that is not owned by anybody. And the problem is that there's nobody there who is protecting the resource, and everybody tries to get it as quickly as possible. The reason you have deforestation in tropical countries is because governments own the land. Alas, 80% of the world's forests are owned by government. And places where it's privately owned, forests are expanding. But that's a larger principle. I would just suggest that. The other one is, and part of what I'm arguing is that, and I'm happy to see, by the way, that E.O. Wilson from Harvard, in his latest book called Half Earth, is agreeing with me. If we're going to save the planet, we have to mobilize human ingenuity and to go through what is some researchers, and I talk about this, called the environmental transition. When poor people start to try to get less poor, they don't care about the environment. They chop things down, they pollute the water, they just want to get some food and shelter for their kids, some education, and the world gets worse. And that's what happened in the United States. And then all of a sudden, we looked around in the 1960s and went, the air is full of crap. When I was a kid, I went up to the Potomac River on a band trip. I was 16 years old, and they take us down to Mount Vernon, and there's a sign bobbing in the river, do not come in contact with water, dangerous to your health. There are beavers living in that stretch of the Potomac River now. So, again, what we're going through is an environmental transition. We have to mobilize every bit of human ingenuity to fix these things. But the problem is that there are the commons problems. How do we regulate the commons when they're really hard to do? One of the things that I completely agree with is, for example, catalytic converters for cars. That was absolutely necessary. The ozone hole. That was a substance, CFCs, the stuff we used to spray under our underarms, and as a refrigerant, to be honest, had to be banned, and we had to control it in that way with an international treaty. The carbon dioxide problem is also pretty much the same problem, and interestingly, I'm fascinated by the Paris Agreement because they're mobilizing a bottom-up approach. The top-down approach that they were trying to do in the Kyoto Protocol was an abject, complete, thorough failure in every possible way. If the Europeans couldn't pull off a carbon market, expecting the entire world to do it is nuts. And this bottom-up process may work. It's very early days. We will see if people keep their promises. But those are the kinds of things that I think are important. With regard to the Eastern Shore, there are a lot of problems. I love the Eastern Shore, but I have some step relatives who live out there. One of the things, the Chesapeake Bay is in pitiful condition because it's a commons. People throw junk into it, and the people take all the oysters out. They overfish, they overcrab, and you get a degraded environment because there's no reason for me to leave that fish in there to grow more fish because the next guy's going to get it. And so there are ways to fix that. And one of the things that Virginia is doing, unlike Maryland, is that they are leasing bottom to people to actually plant and grow oysters. And that is an incremental possible way of improving the Chesapeake Bay. But it's a much longer discussion. But I would suggest to you that you need to look at property rights solutions for the bay itself to try to fix it.
Could I suggest, if you don't mind, John, would you like to pick up the Chesapeake Bay positive?
Sure, so the Chesapeake Bay has problems, and they're difficult problems, and they've been around for a long time, and we haven't been very good yet at solving them. It's interesting, because the bay was attempted to be addressed, the conditions in the bay were attempted to be addressed through a cooperative interstate agreement. The idea is that the federal government would stand back. The states would join in a partnership. They would make agreements. They would jointly commit to goals. They would jointly commit to implementation. And the bay would improve. What happened is that the states jointly agreed to goals. They jointly agreed to implementation. And stuff didn't happen, right? It didn't happen because on the ground it was politically difficult. And because the states were eyeing each other, I mean, the bay is a commons among the states that front it, right? And the states were eyeing each other saying, well, I think I'm doing a little more than the other state. Maybe I should back off a little because I don't want to hurt my economy vis-a-vis the others. I don't want to hurt my oystermen or my farmers and so forth. I think at some point the states realized whether they would say this publicly or not, realize that this was a losing game for them and for the Bay. So the federal government was supported in a more assertive role, and that's what has taken place more recently under some complicated Clean Water Act programs that I won't bore you with, but basically the federal agent has stepped in to foster agreement among the states and to police those agreements so that free riding doesn't take place among the states. And from a theoretical standpoint, you would expect that's exactly what would have to occur. So here's a good example, I think, of where a federal presence is necessary because of the interstate nature of the problem. But it's not sufficient because federal authorities only go so far, and particularly with, I don't know whether you're a farmer or not, but one of the big problems of the Bay is nutrient runoff from agricultural activity. Nutrient runoff is not regulable under the federal act, and therefore it's up to the states to come up with plans, and that's a very difficult thing to do politically. So I'm not sure even with this new regime you're going to get the kinds of water quality improvement that you need. And it's very difficult. I mean, you can, and property works in some cases to do, but it's very difficult to propertize water that's moving across the landscape. Very difficult. So I think that there are initiatives going on in the Bay that are great. I hope they succeed. You raised the question, I think this is an important one. What can you do at a local level to try to get people together to see eye to eye? I mean, the people with an economic stake are going to have a different view than the people who have a bird watching stake or a recreational stake. But in the end, if you're working at the local level, this is what you've got going for you. Everybody shares the same environment. Everybody lives there. The people in South Florida all live there. The water comes whether they're pro-regulatory or anti-regulatory. So that is at least a common basis on which you can work to try to move toward some accommodation, realizing that accommodation is very difficult.
Jed, big money.
Big money. All right. So as long as our accounting systems treat carbon emissions and to a certain degree, certain other types of pollution as economically free, an example of the commons problem and the externalities problem at the base of most of environmental economics that Ron was pointing us to, it'll be as if we were giving a subsidy to fossil fuel industries, for example. And as long as the feedback structure of our political system substantially empowers concentrations of money to work themselves into concentrations of political influence, it will be true that it is as if our political system were not only giving extra votes is the wrong metaphor, really, but I'll use it anyway, extra votes to money, but specifically extra votes to fossil fuel money, because of the level of subsidy in not taking true cost or full cost into account at the beginning. So there's a kind of nexus in which the environmental commons and externalities problem and the problem of money in politics have a multiplicative relationship, I think, to political outcomes. This is also a reminder that while there are awkwardnesses and embarrassments in having governments own resources, there are also awkwardnesses and embarrassments in having private ownership of resources, which is that they do generate enormous concentrations of economic power, which will find a way to express themselves as concentrations of political power. Ron talked about the commons as a key, that is, unowned resources managed in the absence of clear property rights, as the sort of sine qua non of environmental problems. It's quite right that they are the paradigm of modern environmental economics. But I could take you to plenty of places in West Virginia, where I'm from, where privately owned farms, privately owned coal country, have been thoroughly devastated from the point of view of soil health, from the point of view of stream health, from the point of view of the next million years of ecology in the overburdened valley fills and the mountaintop removal regions. And their clear private property rights, whether at the individual level or the corporate level, have just not been enough. One could even argue at the corporate level, as the coal industry tries desperately to stay above water for a few more years before giving in perhaps to the natural gas fracking industry, that it's it has exactly the wrong effect, and it's sort of in its financial death throes, that the entrepreneurial capitalist model of creative destruction that Joseph Schumpeter described as the only way that the system could save itself in the 20th, 21st century, involves a lot of destruction that's not entirely creative as environmental side effect. I think that the broader problem with thinking about property rights as the key to solving environmental problems is, as Ron knows, though they may work very well at the level at which they're sort of organically self-enforcing, like you have a piece of land, you have to live with the consequences of what you do to that land, wasn't enough in a lot of Appalachia, wasn't enough in a lot of New England farming country, but in principle you can see why it should be enough. It's very difficult, and it is very intensively a matter of governance to attempt to extend that logic spatially and through systems that don't stay still in a place that you can actually see. It just does, purely as a pragmatic matter, involve a choice of governing instruments and a lot of political decisions and a lot of administration, and they just haven't found a way around it. And this is very awkward. I say all of this because, without intending any lack of respect to my co-panelists, I think that there are various moments in which, when you look back at them, you understand how the lopsidedness of the political conversation at that time was expressed in the things that people would say. So you read a lot of 50s and 60s talk about the beginning of the recognition of environmental problems and other kinds of problems, and invariably someone would say, you know what we need? We need a big federal agency to solve this problem, and we need some experts to staff that agency. And a lot of things went wrong with that idea. We learned a lot about the limits of that model of change. And the modern economics-oriented libertarian rationalist movement that Ron represents here is a very important corrective to and outgrowth of that moment. At the same time, I'm going to say I feel like we are living at the end of a time where it's been too easy to say, you know what we need? We need some market-based instruments, and we need some property rights, and that'll clear things up. I think that neither turns out to be a silver bullet outside its core competence.
I cannot forbear but pointing out that whatever is going on in Appalachia, which I hail from as well, is occurring for precisely what we discussed earlier, which is the commons in the atmosphere. The carbon is going into the atmosphere. And if there had been a price on carbon, those mountains would still be there.
Which would be a political question.
Okay, last rejoinder.
No.
All right. So I've been strictly instructed to move the argument to the back of the room. Which is to say, there is actually a table in the back for the three of you to move to, so that people can come to you one on one. I want to thank you. There were obviously more questions. Those were three clearly very good and generative ones. Thank you, and thank you to our panelists for being so engaging and lively.